Welcome to GeoTalk, the podcast for geocaches down under. In this episode of GeoTalk, we speak to Dugan from the central Queensland city of Rockhampton. The Ump gives us the lowdown on reviewing your new caches, and part one in our series on waymarking. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 14 of GeoTalk, and the days are certainly getting shorter and it's certainly getting colder, and only the hardy are going out geocaching in Australia. Now, of course, it's not like the Northern Hemisphere where we're all covered under a foot of snow. Only some parts of the country get snow. And even at the moment, with the drought still going on, it's only just starting to get a little bit of snow on the higher peaks. So some of those geocaches that are hidden up in the snowy mountains in the Victorian Alps that did survive the bushfires over summer, they might be a little bit harder to get to, and only some of the more hardy geocache finders will get to those. Now, if you are out and about this winter geocaching, chances are you're participating in the geocaching game River Deep Mountain High, which we talked about in last episode. Now, don't forget, the closing date for this competition is the 30th of June, so it's only a couple of weeks away. If you haven't started, don't worry. Get onto the website at cachinggames.com/RDMH for River Deep Mountain High, and you can still you could even join up, I suppose, the day before that competition closes. But make sure you got to get your 20 requirements in, and there are prizes of Australian geocoins. Now, speaking of which, the Australian geocoins. Now, I'm not into the geocoin whole thing, but I do like looking at them, and I do like seeing them in caches and moving them around. And I have seen the 2007 geocoin on the website, and from all reports, it is fantastic. And I have to give a big rap to Forth Ferrells for doing such a huge amount of work. And I've actually already seen them on eBay, and they're quite highly sought after. So if you've got one of those coins, well done. If you haven't got one, then get involved in the River Deep Mountain High competition and see if you can win one. Thank you very much to all those people who have been burning episodes of GeoTalk onto CD and dropping them in caches. It's really great that you're getting out there and getting the word out about the podcast. And also to Mix, who's printed up little business cards with both the GCA Media website, which includes not only the podcast, but also videos that people have taken from around the country and put them up on the web, on YouTube and so forth. I'll be handing them out at the next event that I'm going out to, which is the Weapons of Mass Distraction event down in Campbelltown, where we're all getting together to get some ammo cans or ammo boxes. So yeah, if you any way that you can promote the podcast or just geocaching in Australia in general, let us know what you're up to, and I'll mention it during each podcast. One of the things I've noticed is that a lot of geocachers are also budding amateur photographers, and Bronze from Dubbo has actually set up a section in the Geocaching Australia forums for things to do with photography, and he's running the second photographic competition, which a bit of a plug, I've actually put in a submission for this one. The theme this month is abstract, so go to forum.geocaching.com.au, go to the photography section, and you can have a look at some of the submissions, and I must say there are some excellent photographers out in the geocaching world. Okay, finally, just some news about the podcast. We have a new domain name, so it's a little bit easier to remember. It's www.geotalkpodcast.com. So bookmark that and share it around the place. That's geotalkpodcast.com. And we now have a phone number. So you can ring in and leave a voicemail any time of the day. I don't have to be here. And it will be recorded on my laptop, and we can put them into the podcast. And the phone number for that is 02, so it's a Sydney number, 850-GEO. So that's 800-50-4336. 850-GEO. Oh, and just before we get into Geocache Profile, of course, the trivia question. You all want to have a bit of a quiz and try and work out over the next 30 minutes what the answer is. It's a two-parter, as they usually are. The first part of the question is, which geocache in Australia has had the most finds logged, and which geocache in Australia has had the most DNFs logged? Answer at the end of the podcast.
Geocacher profile. Hi, this is Nix, and using the wonders of the internet, I'm hopefully about to have a conversation with Dugan from Far North Queensland. Are you there, Dugan?
I'm here, Nix. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Have you been caching lately?
Not for a few weeks now.
And I know the reason why you probably haven't been caching for the last few weeks, but why haven't you been?
Lack of caches, actually. I've got one that's about 2.5 k's away from me that was posted yesterday, but all the others in my local area are over 100 k's away.
So basically it's just the fact that you live in an area where caches are a bit sparse.
Yeah, that's correct.
So do you travel away to go geocaching at all very often?
Some weekends we do. I'll head down to Gladstone. I've been known to do 3-4 hours just to get a cache.
What's the furthest you've ever gone just to do a cache?
Oh, let me see. I'd have to say probably down to Monto, actually, down to Kanaya Gorge there. Can't remember what the cache is. It's down there, but it's the only one in the area. I think it's Dragon's Teeth or Dragon's Cave or something like that. But that's, I'd say it's a good 3.5 hours away.
So, and then obviously you've been away further for other reasons that you might have done some caches. So what's the furthest away that you've from home that you've ever done a geocache?
Dubbo would be the furthest I've ever travelled to do a geocache. But that was just to get in and spend a week with the Bronze and catch up with his family and just sort of do a bit of geocaching at the same time.
So, of all the places you've cached, what would you say is the best place or the best area for caching in your mind?
That's a bit of a hard one, actually. Because I've come across quite a lot of good caches, actually. There's some good ones down in Brisbane. I've done a few down in Dubbo that I quite enjoyed. And there's also one in Gladstone that I really, really like too. It's a bit of a hard one, actually.
Do you have an all-time favourite cache?
Yeah, I do, actually. The one down in Gladstone, I Must Be Dopey, I think it's called. Oh, no, Geez, I Must Be Dopey. That is a really, really good micro. I can't highly recommend that cache.
What part of Queensland is Gladstone in?
It's 100 k's south of Rockhampton, so it'd be North Queensland.
Like, I mean, you've said that there's not a heap of caches around, you know, your area up in North Queensland. How many caches are we talking? Like, not a lot could mean a lot of different things.
I haven't actually had a good record of how many there is, but I'd say there probably wouldn't be any more than 30, maybe 40 in the area.
So there's a real opportunity for somebody if they wanted to pioneer, move to an area and plant some caches, that you'd be welcoming them in your area?
Oh, hell yeah. Just to even get out on a weekend just to do 3 or 4 would be really good.
Some people in areas similar to you, you know, where there's not many caches, have often said to others, you know, if you hide caches here, you know, I'll maintain them as a way of trying encouraging people to hide caches in the area. Is that something that you think is a good idea, or?
I'm doing that for a cache at the moment. If someone was to approach me and ask me, I'd probably would do it, actually. I'd have to say yes.
But there'd obviously be a limit to how many you'd be willing to sort of keep an eye on, do you reckon, or not?
Yeah, I'd have to actually limit it. After a while, it'd probably become a bit too expensive and that sort of thing to actually drive around and that sort of thing. With fuel prices the way they are and that sort of thing, I, suppose, you know, compared to the southern areas, the fuel price is not too bad. But yeah, I'd probably have to limit it to about 10, I'd say.
How many cages have you hidden yourself?
I've got 11 all up myself. One of those is micros. I think I've got a couple of multis, and I think the rest are all traditional.
So how often do you, you know, visit your own caches?
Mostly, if I'm in the area, I'll visit them and check them out. But yeah, on a monthly basis, I'd have to probably say about once, maybe. Maybe once every 2 months, I'd say.
So that's, I mean, that to my, by my mind, that would be, that's fairly regular maintenance. Is, do you think you check your caches more often because there's not a lot out there to find and you want to keep your end in as far as geocaching goes, or do you think that's just good practice in terms of, you know, looking after your caches?
I think it's just good practice, really. I'd have to say that, you know, when I do actually check my caches, I'm actually in the area. I don't specifically, you know, go on and actually, you know, check on them. You know, I wake up one morning and say, oh, I'm going to go and check on five of my caches. It's just if I'm actually in the area, I'll actually check them.
You can always deny that you have any relationship at all, but what's your connection to the Bronze?
Oh, I think I'll deny any connection to him, actually.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me, Mick.
Thank you.
G'day, this is The Ump, also known as Papa Bear Left or PBL, and in some circles as Ian McArath. I've been caching as the bearded half of Bear Left since December 2003, and then in February of 2006, I became one of the volunteer reviewers for geocaching.com. Riblet was basically doing all of the Aussie reviewing at the time, although MB had, and still has, his reviewer account. MB had a new house and a new addition to the family to keep him busy, and Riblet was flat out with his business and Geocaching Australia as well as geocaching.com reviewing. I could see what the situation was, and so I offered to help out. My timing was good, because they were actively looking for a new reviewer at the time, and so I got the gig. One of the things I brought to the table was the fact that I've lived and worked in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney and Perth, as well as Christchurch and Auckland, as well as having visited Tassie and Brisbane several times, so I had some idea of the local settings, and this has occasionally been useful, as well as interesting, to be taken back to some of my old haunts as caches get placed there. As soon as I'd learned the ropes a bit, Riblet backed off and took a well-earned break, and these days he mainly steps back in when I'm travelling or unavailable for some reason. So there's about a 90% chance that your new cache is going to be reviewed by The Ump. I've now published over 4,500 caches, and I've just passed a milestone I'd like to share. I've now done more caches than Macamob. Of course, they had to find or place them, and all I had to do was click the publish button, but hey, we take our milestones where we can find them. So what's involved in reviewing and, hopefully, publishing a cache? It all starts with the review queue. This is a list of all the caches that are ready for reviewing, and it's occasionally 2 pages, there's 20 per page, or on rare occasions 3 pages long. I haven't yet let it get longer than that. Most caches get placed on weekends and then listed on the Sunday or Monday night, so they're by far the busiest days. There's also a few on Fridays, hoping to be published for the weekend, and really only a trickle in between. Most of them are easy. We have some reasonable tools, the main one of which checks to see how close the cache is to the hider's home cohorts, and how close all the waypoints are to all the other caches and waypoints, and a couple of other minor things. Because the additional waypoints feature was only introduced early last year, there's a lot of multi and puzzle caches that don't have their waypoints entered. All but the really old ones usually have an archive note to the reviewer with the cohorts in it, so I usually add them in on all the caches near the one I'm reviewing. I don't keep track of how many of these I've done, but it must be thousands by now, I reckon. Those Grease Monkey scripts for Firefox have made that job a lot easier, and I heartily recommend them to all cache hiders. If you've got older Maltese and puzzle caches, please consider adding in the waypoints. I did that for all our Bear Left caches, and it took about an hour for the 20-odd caches involved. If everything looks okay, then it gets published immediately, and I put it on my watch list. Once there's one or two finds that don't mention any issues, I take it off my watch list, and it's on its own. Probably 60 or 70% of all caches are like this. No problems, published immediately. Others just have, you know, administrivia problems. I've got several templates for the common ones, so I don't have to type the same thing over and over. Hopefully nobody notices this automation, because that'd mean they'd made the same error more than once, and surely no one would do that. Things like Terrain 1 being suggested for use only on wheelchair-accessible caches, adding in additional waypoints, a wrong cache type or missing cache size, you know, that sort of thing. It's usually fixed pretty quickly and published very soon after. There's a few that have typos in the codes, and if they're way, way off, like, you know, in the wrong hemisphere, so they're off the coast of Africa or halfway to New Zealand, then they're pretty obvious. Some just don't look right. A description of a park, but the map looks like a suburban street. Mention of a riverbank, but no river on the map, and that sort of thing. The ones that are 1 degree off but still in the same park, well, that's the risk that the first to find hounds take. Then there are the problem caches. It might just be a proximity issue to a cache that the lister didn't notice, or to a GZ of a multi that they hadn't yet found. These are particularly common for new cache places, who don't know how to check for the nearby caches, and who have a lot of unfound puzzles and multis. One poor Canberra cacher took 4 goes to finally find a hilltop that didn't already have a cache on it, a rare breed in Canberra. If you're placing a cache in a multi-rich area, feel free to email me with the coords or the URL of your disabled cache listing before you go to a lot of effort in the puzzle or the camo, and I'll check them for you and tell you if it's a suitable spot. Some caches just can't be listed, even though there's not many that can't be salvaged in some form with a bit of consultation and thought. Some of them are good caches that just don't fit the guidelines, and some of them are just really bad ideas that I dread seeing appear listing on another listing site. As some of you know firsthand, I'm prepared to put in the time and thought to help salvage a cache, and we've managed to come to compromises that work well on many occasions. As part of Bear Left, I've placed scores of caches, many of them quite involved, and so I know how frustrating it must be to have your great idea blocked, and I don't refuse to publish a cache until and unless I have no other valid choice. I think the reviewing of caches is a good thing, even though I don't add much, if any, value to most cache listings. It's the catching of the few caches that would cause real problems that make it worthwhile to me. And the reasonable expectation that you can go looking for a cache, knowing that it conforms to the guidelines and won't be buried or on private property or hidden between the tracks in a busy railroad bridge and that sort of thing. When people realise the time required to do this job, they ask me why I do it. Some Monday nights, I look at the Hydra-headed review queue and wonder exactly the same thing. Part of it is that I'm an engineer, and I always want to know how things work, and now I'm part of the machinery that makes it work. Part of it is seeing the wonderful puzzles and descriptions and ideas of caches that I'd probably never get to see otherwise. Part of it's the old Protestant work ethic that makes putting back something into the activity that I get so much out of a source of satisfaction. And if I'm honest, part of it's sheer ego trip. It's a way to be a bigger fish in this very small pond. So, read the guidelines. Place some good caches in worthwhile places and or worthwhile ways. Reread the guidelines, and I'll see you in the review queue. Regards, Ian, the Ump.
Well, for the past couple of episodes on GeoTalk, I've promised that we're going to explore the world of waymarking, and joining me to discuss this fairly new and mysterious website is Mix from the Hunter Valley. How are you going?
Good.
Now, we're going to look at the waymarking website, which started about 18 months ago and was born out of geocaching. Now, take us through, Mix, how waymarking first began.
Well, when I first started caching back in 2003, there was a category of geocache called a locationless or reverse cache, But even by that point, it had been grandfathered, so there was no possibility to list new reversed caches. For those who don't know, a reversed cache was exactly that. Instead of being given a set of coordinates and then going and finding something, you were given something to go and find, and you had to then provide the coordinates. Some reverse caches were interesting. I think some of them were kind of woeful, and some of them certainly divided the geocaching community. By the time I started caching, they'd been grandfathered. And then, as you said, about 18 months ago, we got the waymarking website, which essentially replaced not only locationless caches, but also replaced virtuals and webcams, and for a while replaced geocaches, but they're now back with geocaching.com.
Yeah. I've actually noticed that there seems to be two sort of themes to waymarking. One is, as you mentioned there, the locationless or the reverse cache, and then the other is sort of the geocaching without the logbook or without the container, and that's sort of the category where your virtuals and the webcams and for a while, as you mentioned, the earth caches sort of fitted into.
Look, it probably doesn't do everything the way a reverse cache did, and so it's probably not going to appeal to everyone. But it does provide a different aspect of hunting for those who are who are looking for that thrill of the hunt. It's another challenge of trying to find something out there. And as you say, some of them it's more open ended. It could be any type of location within a theme, or for some others it could be a bit more specific.
So let's take a look at the website then. We're at www.waymarking.com. I mean, one of the first things I noticed is that the login that you have for Groundspeak, which is what you use for geocaching.com, you can also use in waymarking.com.
Yeah, I mean, there was some criticism of that when they first did it, populating a new website. But I think it obviously makes sense for them when they've already created one game to sort of make it accessible very easily to people who are already using our site.
So that makes things kind of simple, or makes it a little bit more familiar. And I've also noticed that across the top there's also the My Page tab, which if you click on that, it actually brings up a lot of the stats that you have in geocaching, as well as the ones that you can build up through waymarking.
Anything that you've added to your profile on geocaching.com, so in our case, for example, I just put in a few links and some graphs. They're there on that page, just the same as on geocaching.com. So if I was to change my profile on geocaching.com, it would automatically update it on waymarking. Mm.
Okay, so we get to the waymarking website and we want to go have a look at what waymarks are in our vicinity. What's the first thing that we should do?
Look, it's one of the things that probably is a criticism of the website, waymarking, is that it's probably not as simple and quick to navigate as geocaching.com. And for a lot of people who get to geocaching.com, it's simple. They just throw in a postcode on the very first page, and they can usually find a list of caches in the area. Waymarking's a little bit more fiddly, but partly that's because there's more options available in terms of what you can filter and how you can search for information. But my way of choice would be to simply just click on the waymarks tab at the top of the page, which would take you to a page where you can then do a couple of different types of searches depending on what you're actually looking for, and that'll get you started. It's probably not going to necessarily come up with a lot at the moment, because it is only starting out and there's probably not as many waymarks out there as there are cages, but that's the basic way to get in and do a basic search similar to what you do is you put your postcode in on geocaching.com. Once you've been on the site for a while, one of the features is you can set up locations under your profile, and I've always had a bit of trouble getting it to sort of, it's never been easy, and I think that's something that probably the site needs to refine. But you can, under your profile, set up your locations and make a particular waymark a default location, and you can do searches from a waymark in a surrounding area.
Let's have a look at the categories then. If you click on the categories tab at the top, you will see a whole range of different categories that are listed there that include things like buildings, nature, sports and recreation, structures and so forth. Can you explain to me what the purpose of the categories are?
Waymarking divides all the waymarks into a broad range of categories. Those categories then have subcategories, and eventually they come down to a waymark type. And there's not really a limit, I don't think, in terms of how deep we can go before. You can have categories, and categories can have subcategories, and I think those subcategories can probably have subcategories as well. I mean, under art and music, there's a category called statues, and then under statues, there's a whole number of subcategories like dog statues, equestrian statues, fiberglass statues, and so on. So the categories sort of keep going and going and going. There's not really a limit to how deep they could go, as long as there's a meaningful subcategory that they can be created. The real advantage of the categories is that you can actually choose to ignore categories. Now, at the moment, there's quite a lot of categories there, which means if you wanted to create an ignore list, you'd be probably creating a fairly large one. It's actually easier to, I find, not to ignore any, but just to search within a particular category that you're interested in. So, for example, I particularly like finding the Australian trig points. I have a group which I've involved in, which is guest books, but I also like abandoned railway tunnels. That's quite fun. So I go through and look for a category that I think is interesting, and then sort of focus a bit on it. So pick the category and go with it.
Yeah, as you say, I think that's an there are two ways of sorting these out. One is the ignore function, which I've actually set up myself. I mean, there are things like Canadian trig points that I'm very unlikely to ever go looking for, even if I do get to Canada. But the other one, as you say, is to create favorite categories, so you can give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and you can go back and change those later on. But I think I would say that's probably one of the most important things to do when you're starting off, is just to sort of highlight some of the ones that you're interested in and not try and do all of them. So in my particular case, I've got things such as mountain summits, World Heritage sites, Australian trig points, and observatories, for example.
And one of the things that you can do is, if you're on geocaching.com, on the geocaching.com page, there's usually a link for search for nearby waypoints or waymarks. And so if you're on just a regular cache page on geocaching.com, and you're in an area, you can click on that link and just see if there are any in the area that you might want to go looking for. And so that might be just a way of getting in and starting out using it.
All right, well, let's have a look at the Australian trig points, because it's one that both you and I have listed as a favourite, and you're more heavily involved in it than I am. We do a search in the category for the category Australian trig points, and we open up that category. And when that opens up, we now get a list of the different trig points. Now, obviously, there are thousands of them around the country, and yet on the website we've only got 35 listed. How does that work?
To start with, there's a group of people who started this trig point category. That group, all they do is essentially approve trig points to be listed in this under this category. So they're not going out and finding them, although they do go out and find them as well. It sort of relies on people who want to play the game, just like geocaching relies on people to go and hide the caches so people can go and find them. Waymarking requires people to go and, I guess, not hide the waymarks, but to establish them. And so if you are on the Australian trig points and you scroll down, you'll see that the trig points are there. If you click on any one of them, it will tell you that it was posted by, and in fact I've just clicked on one of yours, Sublime Trig in Wollongong. And that it was posted by Spindock Bob. So you've gone out and taken photos of this trig point, looks like quite a good view, and posted it here, and now it's available for others to go and find. So, like, that would appear in your statistics as being a trig point, which you've established, and it would then appear in other people's, if they go up and find it, appear in theirs as one that they found.
Now, in the next episode, we're going to discuss how you can actually set these up. But I think the important thing to point out here is that even though, for example, I might have set up the Sublime Trig Point app at Wollongong, that doesn't mean that no one else can find it. In fact, that's been set up for other people to find so they can actually log it themselves.
Exactly. I guess that's the key difference between waymarking and what the old locationless caches were, essentially under the old locationless caches. If let's say you created a category called trig points, and I mean there was a locationless cache dedicated to that, a great two dogs one that a lot of people enjoyed, but once the trig point was found, the rules said that was locked out, that only one person could log it. The advantage of waymarking is that, as you said, you've created this sublime point trig by finding it the first time, but now anybody can come along and it can also log it.
Okay, so someone decides they're going to go out to Sublime Trig Point, they click on the link, and obviously now things start to look very much like geocaching.com. I can see we've got the coordinates for south and east, we've got a bit of a description, we've even got a view of where it's located on the map on the right-hand side, and we can read through a description and then what we need to do to log it. So is there anything in particular that anyone has to do when they come up to some of these waypoints?
Some waymarking categories will come with special requirements that you might have to do. So generally speaking, you would read the page that you've just described. And the key one there is that there is a section called visit instructions. So in this case, to log your visit to a waymark, you must post a photo of the trig point with your GPSR in it, or yourself at the location. And please describe your visit to the waymark. So for this one, for this category, there's not a lot you have to do. You just need to find the location, visit it, and get the photo. So very much just like the old virtual. But for others, there might be some special requirements, particularly waymarking games type stuff, and they require you to do a little bit more.
Well, there you have it. That's our first part in looking at waymarking, how to sort of get your way through the site, even though we've pointed out that there are a few little hurdles to get over, but we'll include some links in the show notes so you can get directly to those pages that we've mentioned. And hopefully next episode you'll join me again, Mix, and we'll talk about how to actually set up your own waymarks and maybe even set up a category of your own.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thank you.
Well, that's just about the end of this episode, but a little bit of housekeeping before we finish up. First of all, I got an email from Bewilderbeast down in the ACT. Now, you might recall that I spoke to him as part of a geocacher profile a few episodes back, and he wanted to mention, first of all, that some of the profiles seem to be a bit male-centric, so we're hoping to address that over the next couple of episodes, and thank you to all the listeners who've provided me with a huge list that I have to go through now of different nominees for geocacher profiles. So hopefully you'll hear a few more female voices in upcoming episodes. One of the other things that he also mentioned was, it was actually an answer to a question that I posed all the listeners are two episodes back, and that was, have you noticed a decrease in the number of geocaches hidden in your area? And he suggested that there might be a number of different factors to do with weather and also, you know, the novelty of it during the summer period, but also that in his area in particular, in the Canberra region, one of their more prolific cache hiders is actually a teacher. And of course, teachers at this time of the year are quite busy, and it's not till the summer months when they get to unwind a little bit. Having been an ex-teacher, I know what it's like. So thanks very much, Bewilderbeast, for getting in touch with me with that answer. Now, don't forget, now we've got the phone number, so if you want to leave some feedback, you can just pick up the phone, even pick up your mobile phone, and dial 02-850-GEO. And if you're from overseas, by all means, call in. The country code for Australia is 61, and then just dial 2 for Sydney, and then 850-GEO. All right, well, it's time now for the answer to the trivia question that I asked at the start, and that was, which cache in Australia has had the most number of finds logged? You might be surprised to know it's in Western Australia. It's the Kings Park Travel Bug Hotel, which has 222 logged finds for that geocache. And the cache with the most number of DNFs, well, I'm not surprised with this one. Can You Hear the Bells, Fernando, which is in Canberra on Aspen Island. And if you've ever tried to look for that, you'll know why. It's a very, very intensive muggle zone. Well, that's it for Geo Talk in this episode. In the next episode, part two of our waymarking special, where we're going to discuss how you can set up a waymark and how you can even set up your own categories. We're going to chat with the Wackies from South Australia, and hopefully we might have a little bit of feedback from the Geo Talk phone line. Well, until next time, safe geocaching.